Classical string theory, matrix models, descriptions of those string theories, usually in a very small number of dimensions, actually up to two space-time dimensions. So obviously, since the string that I'll be mostly focusing on is in two space-time dimensions only, there won't be any transverse excitation of the string, and that's what eventually leads to the possibility of having this described by an underlying exactly solvable system. The part where our recent work with my student Cindy Keeler at Berkeley comes in is the M theory part, and I'll be trying to convince you that we can actually understand a three-dimensional M theory lift of these two-dimensional string theories. And many of the interesting physical phenomena about the space-time being an emergent feature that comes from the hydrodynamics of some underlying non-relativistic permi-liquid system, they can be realized both in two-dimensional string theory and lifted also to this M theory picture in three dimensions. So there'll be some more papers coming up on the thermodynamics of the same system. And there's also a paper I wanted to mention. This was my PRL paper from earlier this year, which overlaps significantly with some of the work on non-relativistic Fermi systems that we heard about earlier today from Professor Bawley. And I'll comment on some of those aspects briefly during the talk, because there seems to be some really bizarre and deep parallel between the physics of D-bands in string theory and the physics of non-relativistic Fermi liquids. And we would definitely want to understand that parallel better. Why is there such an interesting mathematical parallel between those two physical systems? So the common feature I want to be focusing on is, what is the connection between strings and permi-liquids? I won't be developing any systematic theory for why these two seemingly different branches of physics should be connected. By strings, I mean the fundamental superstring theory, which supposedly gives us quantum theory of gravity. And permi-liquids, I won't explain what I mean by that. The intriguing relations that we've started seeing in recent years are many, where in string theory, various non-relativistic Fermi systems emerge as fundamental descriptions of various aspects of string theory. Let me just mention a few examples. One of them is the non-critical string theory in two space-time dimensions, which is a very deep subject. String theory goes all the way back to the early 90s or even late 80s, when people were trying to define non-perturbatively the sum over Riemann surfaces, string worksheets, dynamical triangulations of worksheets of the string, and try to define non-perturbatively an extension of the perturbative string theory that was available at that time. And it turned out that if you decide that your string theory is only in up to two space-time dimensions, you can produce an equivalent, kind of dual description of the triangulation of these random surfaces of the worksheet of the string in terms of a matrix model. This is a matrix model which is described by a zero plus one dimensional quantum mechanics of some large m by n Hermitian matrix in this inverse case. And this quantum mechanics in the large n limit, in fact, in a slightly fancy version of the large n limit, which is called the double scaling limit, it turns out to be equivalent to two things. On one hand, it ends up being equivalent to a theory of non-relativistic free fermions, which reflect off of a very simple inverted harmonic oscillator potential. Or, on the other hand, this becomes completely non-perturbatively equivalent and defines for you a two-dimensional string theory in a particular class of two-dimensional backgrounds. So this type of duality at that point was kind of ad hoc, and we didn't have any good understanding why that was true, or the people who worked on those things back in the early 90s didn't have any particular systematic understanding why string theory should be describable by these double-scale matrix models. However, in the recent years, there's been a resurgence of interest in these matrix models of the early 90s, initiated by the work of John McGreevy and Herman Perlita, who were able to show that this matrix model versus two-dimensional string theory duality is a pre-example of what we now understand as a gauge gravity duality, or an open string, closed string duality, of which the most celebrated example is the ADS-CFT correspondence. So they were able to understand that in the matrix model side, the quantum mechanics of a large N matrix as a description of the open string degrees of freedom on a bunch of these zero grains, And then when you switch from this description to the gravitational Lewis description, you end up describing a system which grows an extra space dimension. So you end up with a holographic description of a system which is no longer a 0 plus 1 dimensional matrix mechanics, but it ends up being a 1 plus 1 dimensional string theory. And that's the gravitational side of the duality. So let me list a few more examples. The example that is personally exciting for me is this recent work we were able to do on the non-critical F theory, which shows us that these two-dimensional string theories do have an actual lift to three dimensions, with the third dimension being basically generated by the existence of these zero brains, which can carry Kolchak line, modes along an extra space-time dimension. And this is a very interesting feature which mimics the emergence of the 11th dimension in critical superstring theory, and also sheds some new light potentially on what M theory might be even in that critical case of 11th space-time dimension. And it turns out that this non-critical M theory, which should live naturally in 2 plus 1 space-time dimensions, has again a dual description in terms of a non-relativistic Fermi liquid, which is now 2 plus 1 dimensional. And another beautiful example from recent years goes under the name of LLM, which refers to the authors of an influential paper, Lin Wonin and Bandasena, who found out that when you try to classify a certain huge class of half DPS, highly supersymmetric geometry of type 2B string theory with some specific types of symmetries, they end up being mapped to the phase space distribution of non-relativistic fermions in 1 plus 1 dimensions, again by the famous ADS-CFD correspondence. So what you end up with is a beautiful moduli space, classical solutions of some general theory of relativity coupled to a specific set of fields. And within that class of models, you even have the extremal Reitzner-Nordström black hole solution in 5 dimensions as a specific subclass. And you have a dual description of all these moduli spatial geometries in terms of a fully unitary quantum mechanical system of non-relativistic fermions in 1 plus 1 dimensions, which defines for you, in fact, a quantization of this moduli space of gravitational solutions. So in all these cases, what are the fermions? Why are we seeing these fundamental fermions which are mysteriously dual to some gravitational systems? It turns out that when you trace the physical origin of these fermions in all these examples I mentioned before, they are all secretly related, or not so secretly, related to D-brains. There are D-brain degrees of freedom. D-brains, for those few of you who perhaps don't know what D-brains are very simple stringy space-time defects defined simply as surfaces in space where open strings can end. Those are typical stringy, non-real theoretical defects. And what these recent lessons seem to be teaching us is that the D-brains themselves, even though the way I define them is using an embedding into a fixed ambient space-time, those D-brains are somehow more fundamental, perhaps, than the space-time geometry itself. And in many ways, you can reconstruct the full space-time geometry from some quantum mechanics of whatever the D-brains reduce themselves to, which in many cases is a system of fermions, which don't see the particular space on which the original D-brains live. So that seems to be a very strange and unusual lesson of which we understand only a small part. It's all connected ultimately to the gauge gravity duality, where on the gauge side you have gauge fields living on a bunch of D-brains, which is a non-gravitational system. And on the gravitational side of the duality, so this is a sort of holographic relation, on the gravitational side, you look at the same D-brain system in a dual point of view as a geometry which comes from the back reaction created by the presence of the D-brains on the background. And then, of course, the natural degrees of freedom of that would be gravitational ones, and you end up describing the same physical system in terms of some theory of gravity. So that probably is somehow the ultimate reason why D-brains can capture a lot of the space-time physics, but we don't quite understand in detail how that works out. So again, I wanted to point out that those topological invariants of which we saw two examples this morning, which classified these gapless modes in Fermi liquids on various Fermi surfaces of various dimensions, Fermi points, Fermi lines, Fermi surfaces. You can generalize this to an arbitrary number of dimensions. And You can ask, how would you classify all such topological invariants? They turn out to be related to a generalized cohomology theory, which is known as K theory. And that's a very bizarre and surprising fact. First of all, it might be of great interest to condensed matter physicists because they didn't have any systematic classification of those invariants. And now you can take a particular physics system and ask, what is the K theory that classifies possible stable Fermi surfaces? And the mathematician can give you the answer. You don't have to work hard on a case-by-case basis in your system to figure out what the low energy dynamics, what the universality classes of behavior might be. But the K-theory classification is fascinating for quantum gravity because it turns out that the same type of K-theory groups classify also other objects in physics, namely vibrants themselves. The charges of vibrants in string theory are also known to be classified by K-theory. So this deep mathematical parallel between Fermi surfaces and Fermi liquids in a non-relativistic higher dimensional Fermi liquid and the classification of Lie charges of string theory. Lie are supposed to be completely stringing defects which have nothing to do with conventional quantum field theory. This seems to be a very interesting and puzzling, intriguing phenomenon. So the outline of the talk would be something along these lines, where I'll be stressing more the type 0A and 0B versions of two-dimensional strings. I'll mention a few aspects of how this leads to M-theory, but I don't want to stress too much the M-theory aspect of the story, because the lessons that we can learn, which are covered here in the third part of the talk, namely that the emergent spacetime is equivalent to effectively being the hydrodynamics of the Fermi surface of the non-relativistic Fermi system, those conclusions are universal, independent of whether you look at 1 plus 1 dimensional string theory or 2 plus 1 dimensional M-theory. So this will be the highlight, I suppose, of the talk. And I'll be skipping many technical aspects. So those of you who want to know technical details, I would refer you to the weekend discussions. And among the emergent spacetime features that we can get here, let me mention as a preview at least one, which is the possibility of having time-dependent solutions, which from the spacetime point of view can look as follows. For example, you can have a theory which at very early times starts off as a string theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions, evolves through some 2 plus 1 dimensional phase, of which you have only limited understanding, and then at late times it decays to another, perhaps different string theory. And this very weird process where you even lose dimension or gain a dimension of space-time as time progresses can be described by a completely unitary underlying dynamics of the Fermi system, which is dual to this gravitational picture.
Space time or three dimensional in this case. So 1 plus 2 dimensions.
1 plus 2.
Does this space time
have gravitons? It doesn't have gravitons. So that's it. It does. It's not topologically. That's propagating degrees of freedom which can back react on and on. And I mean, there's dynamical gravity, but of course contains no local fluctuations. But there is a massless field which propagates on top of this background. So in particular, you can calculate asymmetric scattering processes. Arguably, that has to do with the fact that we are in a low enough dimension so that there are no transfer excitations of the string. This barrier of being only allowed to live in up to two dimensions in these exactly soluble string models, it's a famous so-called C equals one barrier of old-fashioned matrix models for string theory. And what happens when you try forcefully to go beyond this 1 plus 1 dimensional limit, it turns out that the string would naturally want to live in some kind of a branch polymer phase. And you lose any control over some smooth space-time geometry for those types of backgrounds. But I'll be certainly focusing on physics in 1 plus 1 or 2 plus 1 dimensions, which I think is rich enough in this case, even though it doesn't contain the Hilbert space of propagating gravitons. To be honest, I don't know of any sensible quantum theory of gravity outside of maybe AES-CFT correspondence, which would contain what you could identify as the Hilbert space of propagating gravitons and would still make quantum mechanical sense as far as known examples. So
we'll talk about that
again. Okay. Or you can have another class of solutions where you start off perhaps with one string theory and decay your space-time not to another string theory at the late times, but your space-time completely decays into nothing from the perspective of the space-time observer. However, from the point of view, again, of the dual fermions, the D-brains, which kind of define the system for it quantum mechanically, this could be described as a completely old-fashioned, traditional emptying of the Fermi surface of the fermions. So that's a conventional quantum mechanical consistent process, which to the space-time observer looks like some kind of a terminal singularity of space-time, or a space-time decay into nothing, or perhaps some kind of a big crunch singularity. Okay, so non-critical states and non-critical M theory. My personal motivation is also to learn more about this famous impressionistic starfish diagram of what string theory looks like. You're supposed to understand these corners of this big diagram in string correlation theory, or perhaps by looking at 11-dimensional supergravity. But since the second string revolution in 1995 or so, you're supposed to also understand that all these different corners are related by various non-contributive dualities. And therefore, they're believed to be a part of one big space of solutions of one mysterious theory, let's call it M theory. But we don't really know what this M is. And we would like to know how to solve this theory eventually, how to find perhaps whether it has one solution or ten zillions of solutions. And this landscape of vacua of the theory has been discussed recently in quite some detail. However, we don't quite really have any definition even of what that landscape should look like. So how do you start in doing any statistics of vacua on a space of which you have a very limited understanding? So it would be great to have also some kind of an exactly solvable model where you can exactly control the space of all such solutions of the theory. And our claim is that this non-critical M theory, defined in terms of two plus one dimensional fermions, provides such a solvable example. So let me start with the slightly more technical part. How would you define this one plus one dimensional theory? Let's call it zero B theory for technical reasons. You don't have to know what that name is. These types of one plus one dimensional theories have an interesting feature. If you look at them from the point of view of the target manifold in which the string worksheet propagates, you have a spatial dimension, which is called the little dimension phi, and there is a non-trivial linear Dirac-Lehmann field on that extra dimension, on the spatial dimension. That's the reason why this algorithm solves the equation of motion of string theory. So in particular, even though you have light cones, local light cones, and the metric on this space is Minkowski metric in two dimensions, this is the time dimension, you don't have Lorentz invariants because the linear Dirac-Lehmann background breaks Lorentz invariants. And since the string coupling is known to be related in string theory to the vacuum expectation value of the Dirac-Lehmann, and if the Dirac-Lehmann depends linearly on this dimension, you'll have a weakly coupled N, and you'll have a strongly coupled N in this theory. And this will be important in a few minutes when I try to explain why this type of string theory is described by this particular quantum mechanics, some mysterious and by animations N. So forget now this two-dimensional string theory, and let's consider the quantum mechanics, which is going to be a UN gauged theory. So I'll be only considering the singlet states in a theory described by a Hermitian matrix. And I'll be taking the double scaling limit, which takes n to infinity and identifies yet another parameter, which is being taken to zero and keeps their ratio constant. That ratio will eventually be identified with the inverse string coupling constant of this string theory. Don't ask me why. Let's postpone that question for the weekend discussion, because this has a very long history. This matrix model comes from trying to discretize the random surfaces which populate this type of one plus one dimensional space-time. And by old-fashioned methods, you can reduce this matrix model to a very simple system. First of all, since we are gauging the UN symmetry acting on the matrices, the physical degrees of freedom will be only the singlets inside the matrix, namely the eigenvalues. And if you want to reduce this to the system of the n eigenvalues of the matrix, you want to switch in the path integral from the representation using these matrix elements of m to the representation by the eigenvalues and some angular variables on their root manifold, over which you're integrating. And this Jacobian transformation will produce a factor which gives a Fermi statistics to the eigenvalues. which is a famous old argument, and leads to an equivalent description of the dynamics of this large N matrix in the singlet sector as n eigenvalues, lambda 1 through lambda n, living on some space lambda. This space lambda is the spatial coordinate on which these eigenvalues can be thought of as fermions spread along in some n different locations. This lambda is supposedly related to the spatial dimension phi of the physical space-time in which the string theory lives. But this is actually the crux of the whole thing. There is a highly non-local, non-trivial relation between this dimension phi and this dimension lambda that comes from the eigenvalue of the matrix. And this also explains why the metric on the space given by this eigenvalue lambda and the time dimension t is just flat, non-relativistic. That geometry never changes. It just sits there as a kind of auxiliary structure, which allows you to formulate the quantum mechanics of the system in terms of some second quantized Fermi field psi, which depends on lambda and t. So first of all, you see how second dimension, in addition to time, you grow a spatial dimension, lambda, comes from the eigenvalue of the matrix. And you also see that this lambda will be a dimension on which a second quantized field theory for the eigenvalues will be living. So you can reformulate the quantum mechanics of those n eigenvalues in terms of a second quantized non-relativistic Fermi field.
For non-Hermitian matrix, you look at a two-dimensional fermion.
Well, that's a very complicated question. And there is no simple motivation for a non-Hermitian matrix. Well, one particular model with a non-Hermitian matrix would be on the next transparency, but that's just because that's a rectangular matrix where you gauge U n cross U n gauge symmetry. Ultimately, the reason why this matrix is Hermitian is that we now have a beautiful interpretation to this old-fashioned matrix model in terms of the dual system of these zero banks, which is the work of McGreevy and Ferlinde that I was mentioning before. Roughly speaking, the idea is take this two-dimensional string theory and consider these zero banks in this background. These zero banks have the famous property that the tension scales as the inverse string coupling. So if the string coupling is weak here and strong here, it would prefer living here instead of fluctuating towards the weakly coupled end. In fact, they don't have any physical transverse excitations on this dimension at all. They're completely frozen in the strongly coupled end, and they just produce this background for you. And then you look at the word line theory on n such p zero banks, and there will be just one mode for each pair of these zero banks. There will be one tachyonic field, namely the ij element of this matrix M. This also explains why there is an inverted harmonic potential. Inverted harmonic potential, harmonic oscillator potential in this matrix model, because it just tells you that these modes are really tachyonic modes with this type of potential. And the interesting physics of that double scaling limit, which defines the string theory for you, zooms in on the top of this tachyonic potential. So by this duality, you're supposed to look at this model and interpret it as the collection of large n, these zero banks, in this strongly coupled n from this space-time, which, by their tachyon condensation, basically give rise to this entire holographic dimension of space. The space dimension wasn't there in the matrix model, but it was created through this complicated relation between lambda and the physical dimension phi of the string sees. So the double scaling limit actually assumes that you are supposed to look at the system where you fill with these individual n fermions all the available states up to some Fermi energy away from the top of the potential, and then you're supposed to zoom in on the top of the potential while scaling the Fermi energy to zero. The way to do that would be to send epsilon f to zero, Fermi energy measured in this particular way, and keep the double scale Fermi energy mu, which is defined as epsilon f times n, finite as you send n to infinity. So this is the double scaling limit that defines string theory. There is a dual model, which is actually precisely t dual to the first one. If you were to Euclideanize the time dimension, compactify in a circle, and t dualize, you will get this different looking version of two-dimensional string theory, which is known as the type 0a string theory. And that's quite a different metrics model. I don't want to get into the technical details. There's also a tachyonic interpretation of this bunch of matrix elements as tachyons on some coincident system of D0 and anti-D0 grains. The reason why we get now D0 and anti-D0 grains is that in this type 0 A string theory, D0 grains are allowed to carry a charge under a Ramon-Ramon field, which is another famous property of D grains. If they are stable, they are typically charged under a Ramon-Ramon gauge field. And in this 0 A theory, there are stable D0 grains. And that immediately raises a question. We know how, in the case of type 2 A string theory in net dimensions, the existence of D0 grains gave rise to the 11th dimensional M theory. Because D0 grains, if you were looking at a bunch of D0 grains with some charge equal to Q, those were interpreted as Q units of counterfine momentum on an extra dimensional M theory. So you can ask whether a similar interpretation can be given to this value Q of the D0 grain charge in this type of matrix model. And it turns out that to some degree, this is connected to the question that I was asked by Professor Wang, that you can, in this particular case, interpret this value of Q as the angular momentum on a two-dimensional spatial plane and promote the eigenvalues into being complex eigenvalues when your Fermi system ends up living in 2+1 dimensions. And then we would like to interpret this angular momentum dimension on the plane of these fermions as related to the S1 dimension of M theory. In other words, the U1 symmetry that rotates the angular plane on the plane on the two-dimensional Fermi system is the same U1 symmetry that would rotate you on the S1 dimension or a three-dimensional M theory related on these two-dimensional strings. How much time do I have?
About
15 minutes.
All right, so turns out that this can be done, and I skip these transparencies because what I just said leads to the following description. We can now say, let's start from scratch and let's just define, let's postulate that there is a theory which is described by this very simple elementary 2+1 dimensional non-relativistic second quantized Fermi system. And this would be a system which lives on a non-relativistic 2+1 dimensional spacetime, lambda, now is a complexified eigenvalue. And I'm allowing all different sectors of different values of Q, where Q in the type 0 A string theory was fixed. Now I'm allowing all different values of Q, all different sectors of angular momenta are allowed to contribute. And the potential that this fermion C is, again, the inverted harmonic oscillator potential, and I'm again taking a double scaling limit, which happens to be identically the same as in the case of string theory. And the claim is that this is the form of the potential. The claim is that this, first of all, does define an interesting 2+1 dimensional theory, which we can call non-critical M theory. And you can also show that it is a theory of free fermions in this double scaling limit. Some technicalities, and you can show that both type 0A and type 0D string theories in particular emerge as some specific vacua in this system of fermions in 2+1 dimensions. Basically, what you can do is to say, let me fix a value of Q that fixes the value of angular momentum, and let me fill the n lower states of the fermions only in the sector with this fixed value of the angular momentum up to some Fermi energy. And let's leave all other sectors with different other values of angular momenta empty. And this can be proven mathematically to define precisely the same system of fermions that define the type 0A string theory before. So this would be the embedding of the type 0A string theory into this M theory.
Like my understanding is that there's an infinite number for energy level to be filled, right?
In the after the double scaling limit. But during the double scaling limit, you have to regularize this by some finite cutoff and finite n, and then you're taking n to infinity and the cutoff goes to infinity. You have to be performing that reasonably carefully, otherwise you get nonsense. So we can talk about the technicalities later, but that's an important part of the definition. You cannot just say, I'm already in the double scaling limit. You have to carefully take the double scaling limit, otherwise it's meaningless. And similarly, you can get the other, the 0D string theory out of this. And that's not particularly important. Let me go over different expansions back to discuss the general philosophy. This system, in the double scaling limit, becomes a system of free fermions. Even before you take the double scaling limit, it's a relatively controlled system. And what this leads to is that we understand mathematically precisely what the space of all states is of the system. It's a system of all fermions, so it's a bunch of creation and annihilation operators satisfying the conventional anti-commutation relations. And you just decide which states are filled and which ones are empty. Take that as an initial state and it evolves consistently. So you know mathematically precisely what the space of all solutions is. Now, since this is a system of free fermions, I can pick any canonical pair of creation and annihilation oscillators. And independently of what the others do, I can decide how they act in my, on my Young state. This means that there doesn't have to be any correlation between different such canonical pairs of fermions. And therefore, the generic state that you get by just choosing case by case for each pair of canonical operators, how they act on the vacuum, you get some random state in the space of all states that the fermions can occupy. And only for a small subsector of those states, you'll have a smooth hydrodynamic Fermi surface. That takes a lot of conspiracy of all different creation and annihilation operators to fill, let's say, all lowest energy states up to some Fermi energy. They have to conspire. Usually what we do in relatively condensed matter systems, we allow them to interact. And they, of course, reach some kind of a ground state. Here, this in the double scaling limit ends up being an exactly solvable system of non-interacting fermions. It's an infinite, double infinity symmetry algebra. So you're not even allowed to make them interact because you'll be outside of the scope of this theory. And therefore, there is no particular reason to prefer these smooth states, which have smooth Fermi surfaces, from any random occupation of all available states by some collection of n fermions. But our claim is that it's only these states which have a smooth hydrodynamic description in terms of bosonic excitations of the Fermi surface, which actually give rise to the space-time description. So for the technicalities, I guess we'll have to leave it for the weekend, but you can trust me that the hydrodynamic fluctuations of a Fermi surface in those states which do have a nice semi-classical Fermi surface are precisely mapped, in the case of string theory, to massless so-called tachyon excitations. That's a misnomer. There's a massless field in this two-dimensional string theory, which for historical reasons is called a tachyon. It has a non-trivial S matrix as it reflects off of the strongly coupled region. And you can calculate particle production S matrix amplitudes off of this background. This highly non-trivial scattering S matrix of this string theory background gets precisely mapped to the calculations of fluctuations of Fermi surface. Of course, that picture makes sense only in the case of those states for which there is a smooth hydrodynamic description.
Excuse me. What are the Fermi energy spectrum, you know, the many-body spectrum, have anything to do with space-time energy level spectrum? I mean, what eigenvalue have a correspondence now between
the fermions? No, there is no. The tachyon, the fermions are basically the eigenvalues of the matrix of tachyons on a bunch of these neurons which are frozen here. So there is a.
That's a highly incorrect. But in the fermion system, you also have an eigenvalue video. In the free fermion system, you know, it's harmonic oscillator, you don't. Right. You can have an energy eigenvalues.
The eigenvalues are continuous. In the double scaling limit, you get pretty much one state for each value of the energy, modulo some discrete degeneracy, maybe some parity in the space of type 0A. I'll be happy to discuss the technical aspects. They actually appeared on one of the transparencies that I had to skip over. Okay, so the only thing I want to say about the 2 plus 1 dimensional natural vacuum of this M theory is that it can be defined and has some really fascinating symmetry properties, which at this stage probably only the string theorists in the audience will appreciate, so I don't particularly feel like spending too much time on them, but they are really amazing. and really enjoyed his work for this several hours. And then, after all this, dust settles. Well, maybe one thing I can mention, the string theory is in the audience. There is one really cute property which is so far unpublished, but should appear. I've been saying since September that it will appear next week. I don't know if you're there. So. If you look at the system in the canonical ensemble by Euclideanizing the fan dimension, compactifying it on a radius R circle, R being effectively the inverse temperature of the system, you can calculate the exact partition function. And then you can decide to expand it in the parts of the inverse temperature, or in other words, in the part of R. And you stare at the individual terms in the expansion, and what you realize is that this is precisely, and I mean precisely, the genus expansion to all orders of the topological A-model string theory on a result conic form, where the radius of this M-theory circle is precisely the string coupling of the result conic form A-model. So the claim is now that this non-critical M-theory is actually providing for you the M-theory of the A-model. Some of you might appreciate this information. We can discuss this during the so there are lots of symmetries and lots of observables, which I don't want to spend any time on. But there is this part where we can really show that there are semi-classical equations of motion for the Fermi surface. They look simply like this, where you have, in this double scaling unit, what happens is, that you're also taking a semi-classical limit of this Fermion system. I should have said that earlier, probably, but as a part of the large N limit, you're basically taking the effective H bar to zero in this Fermion system. So you can describe everything in terms of the dynamics in a phase space, which will be, in the case of M theory, 2 plus 2 dimensional from the spatial and momentum dimensions of the phase space, plus there could be a time dependence. So if you have a smooth Fermi surface, it will be a 4-dimensional hypersurface in a 5-dimensional extended phase space. And the classical equation of motion for fermions will translate into a classical equation of motion for the function, the profile of the Fermi surface. Here we were just basically mimicking the same type of analysis which was done in the lower dimensional case of string theory by Polchinski some 12 years ago or so. So this is just a 5-dimensional equation of the same type for the Fermi surface in M theory. And the claim is that this is the classical equation. If you have a system which, in the semi-classical limit, does have a smooth Fermi surface, it has to satisfy this semi-classical equation of motion. So this is a bosonic equation. You can study the fluctuations over the Fermi surface. And in particular, you can get lots of interesting solutions from this classical equation of motion. And they should correspond to semi-classical spacetimes on the dual gravitational side. You can have static solutions. They'll have some very simple looking spacetimes on the gravity side. Those are not particularly exciting for now here. There's some interesting velocity, which I don't want to get into either. But I want to mention that there are some very simple time-dependent solutions. And from the point of view of the Fermi surface inside phase space, they look very natural. They basically use the existence of this infinite collection, infinite hierarchy of conserved charges, and they allow you to have Fermi surfaces which are being emptied or filled on various dimensions in phase space. These are perfectly natural solutions of the classical equation of motion for the Fermi surface that I wrote down. This is an example. And you can believe me, or you can ask me later why. This is actually that type of solution that I announced at the beginning of the talk. This, when you translate this type of Fermi surface into the space-time description on the gravity side, will translate precisely into a space-time which at early times starts off as one string theory, and at late times decays into another string theory, and at the intermediate stages goes through the M-theory phase. And by just very simply adding a few more terms, we can generate an infinite hierarchy of time-dependent solutions, most of which either originate or end in a space-time singularity of a Big Crunch or a Big Bang type, or the space-time otherwise decays by some kind of attacking condensation process. From the point of view of the fermion system, this is just time-dependent Fermi surface in a perfectly well-defined system of even free fermions with an infinite symmetry algebra.
From your surface, it's from your point, from your line, or from your surface.
This is an honest surface. These are spinless fermions.
So, I mean, it's a two-dimensional, like a three-dimensional fermion surface.
It would be a
one-dimensional fermion.
It is three-dimensional.
It is three-dimensional in a four-dimensional space.
But the fermion system looks like two-dimensional. Yeah.
No. It's a semi-classical limit that I'm taking, so I can start consistently look at the Fermi surface inside the entire phase space, not just in momentum space, up to corrections of order h bar, which I'm sending to zero.
Fermi surface, the surface, so it will be three-dimensional space.
In the four-dimensional phase space, plus it could depend on time. So if you're looking at a four-dimensional surface in a five-dimensional space.
So Fermi surface itself has a dimension of four dimension or three dimension.
Well, if you want to undo the semi-classical limit, then this is just a Fermi line on a in a two dimensional in the two plus one dimensional Fermi system. That's what you're asking. So I'm ready to conclude. The conclusions I think are still left for the discussion part of the meeting. There are some conclusions for M theory. Maybe you're learning some interesting features of what M theory might be, how it's related to the hydrodynamics of D-brains being praised as fermions. This might be related to K theory, but also for quantum gravity, there are lessons. First of all, this could be a dual way of actually getting a handle on space-times in decay or are generated by a big bang type of scenario, while the underlying quantum mechanics is there for all eternity. The underlying quantum mechanical time just sits there from minus infinity to plus infinity. It doesn't care that this effective space-time is decaying or not. And also I want to say that this particular three-dimensional theory is sitting somewhere between the topological transcendence, which has two few degrees of freedom, and the full string theory on a three-dimensional compact pi down to the three-dimensional manifold, which has too many degrees of freedom. This one has just a few degrees of freedom, so it's not a topological theory. But the exact calculations of the partition function that it has time to go into were actually showing that it shares many features of a topological theory. So this might be also an example of how you can combine topological features, some kind of a topological phase of gravity, with having propagating degrees of freedom. And ultimately, to me, this is an example of a Machian theory, where by Machian Sutra, I would say, I mean that if you don't have any degrees of freedom, no partons sustaining your space-time, there is no space-time, which is precisely the case here. Thank you.